From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, with the 4th of July holiday at hand, we look at what you can and can't shoot off in Michigan. Plus, grab your paddle because paddle sports are bigger than ever.
We've got the best water for paddling and most diverse water probably between Maine Coast and Seattle's Puget Sound.
Sports commentator John Eubacon on the Women's World Cup and that bloody head-to-head collision between an American and German player.
You need a doctor on the sidelines. Look, at that level, that much money sloshing around, these TV ratings and so on, they have no problem affording that.
And poetry on Mackinac Island.
So I was really part of a tradition on the island of there being some sort of a literary event every week on the island.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. President Obama made it official this week. The United States and Cuba will soon open embassies in Havana and in Washington. And wasting absolutely no time at all, the Cuban Chamber of Commerce has announced it's opening an office in Oakland County. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, trading with Cuba. But first, the 4th of July weekend is finally at hand. And in addition to reaching for a hot dog or a burger, more and more Michiganders this weekend will be reaching for a paddle. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is back with us. Daniel, we're used to having you explore the auto industry and labor talks and financial challenges in Detroit or Michigan, but today it's paddle sports. Just what is going on with paddling in Michigan?
It's kind of exploding. There's a growing interest in all forms of it, from sea kayaking to recreational boats down around Belle Isle to stand-up paddle boards, which have become the new hot rage. And, you know, they should in a state like Michigan. We've got the best water for paddling and most diverse water probably between Maine Coast and Seattle's Puget Sound.
And you do quote one canoe livery owner as saying, something has happened, some unknown force has pushed a bunch of buttons, and the business in Michigan has just gone berserk. When did this happen, and why do you think it did?
Well, it's really hard to put a finger on it. I mean, there's clearly, as I quote somebody in the piece, a coach out of Lansing, Scott Faherty, I mean, paddling is more accessible than it's ever been before. And there's a lot of places that rent. There's a lot of places that teach. At the top of the column, there's this story of RKC Adventures, which is now going to be running a canoe livery on Belle Isle, or a paddling livery, I should say, because it is canoes and kayaks and stand-up paddleboards and bikes. Mm. And they're just putting it together this week. They're open for business, but they're still kind of ironing out the kinks. And there were some people there yesterday renting boats and paddling around lagoons and the canals of Belle Isle. Now, they can't get out onto the Detroit River from there, which is probably a good thing because the Detroit River can be a little tricky. I've paddled it several times, and between the current and whatever winds you have, it can be a bit of a challenge.
In fact, it makes me think, as I was reading your column, of those vintage photos from, you know, 1905 of people paddling their canoes in those Belle Isle lagoons. So it's nice to see that everything old is new again.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think this is a great story. It is a great story about something that's special to Michigan. I've really come to appreciate this in the last few years as my wife and I have gotten more involved in sea kayaking and discovering the sea kayaking and community in Michigan and the diversity of the water. We've got everything from inland lakes and rivers to obviously the Great Lakes, which grow up all the way to the big lake of Lake Superior, which is the mother of them all. So, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity and diversity here, depending on how you want to embrace it.
And as you point out in your piece in the news today, the fact that people are going to be heading to Belle Isle now and thinking of any kind of paddle sports says a lot about how our perceptions have changed of the Detroit River.
Well, I think that's right. I talked to one person who said when they got into the kayaking business and they were going to be located on the Detroit River, people said, are you out of your mind? You know, this place is an industrial sewer. But in fact, it's really not. In those intervening 10 or 12 years, it's gotten to be a much better story. The riverfront in Detroit has gotten cleaned up. We've got the riverfront park by the Renson. Belle Isle is now in the process of getting cleaned up under state supervision. And they're bringing back some things that were there before, to your point, and canoeing is one of them. And I think if we fast forward a few years, this is going to be even more appreciated. And I would expect to see more paddling there, not only this weekend, but throughout this season. I can tell you I'm going to be down there on the 4th for a few hours paddling around Belle Isle.
Well, it just makes me stop and remember my family had a little cottage near Kalkaska on the Manistee River and didn't have a lot of money, but we bought a little canoe. And my brothers and I used to love going the 3.5 hours from the Triple C Bridge, the Civilian Conservation Corps Bridge, to the North Sharon Bridge. And it was great. And you can have a lot of fun and not spend a lot of money doing it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, if you go out and you look at high-end canoes and high-end kayaks, they're only going to cost you, you know, $2,000-$3,000 as opposed to trying to get a jet ski or motorboats or whatever. You know, and for some people that may be a lot of money, but comparatively to a motorboat, it's not a lot of money, and it can be a lot of fun. And you can explore an awful lot of things. And, you know, it's an important part of our tourism economy here in Michigan, and that's really why I was interested in it as a kind of a business story at this time, is that there is demand, and people are groaning a little bit under the demand and saying, geez, it's really hard for us to keep up. I quoted a guy from Heaveners Canoe Livery out in Milford, and he bought 35 new kayaks last year, and he says they've been in continual use every weekend since last season into this season. There's just increased demand from school groups, corporations wanting to do team building, and just your average weekenders who want to go out and have a good time like you did with your brothers, those many years ago,
and it would be, you know what, and you don't have to be some kind of physical god to be able to do it. Anybody can get out and paddle and enjoy, unless you've got a torn rotator cuff.
Well, that's exactly right. But no, paddling is one of those things that you can do well in at any age, and you can do it well into your 70s and 80s and beyond, depending on what kind of paddling you're doing. And I think that's what also is nice about it, is it's physically accessible and it's more financially accessible for a lot of people.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with paddle firmly in hand. Happy 4th of July and have a good time on Belle Isle.
I will. Thank you.
It was 2011 when state lawmakers loosened up Michigan's fireworks law, allowing just about any consumer-grade fireworks to be sold. Instead of being legally limited to those low-impact ground fireworks like sparklers and poppers, we could buy aerial fireworks, bottle rockets, Roman candles, big, high-powered fireworks. And sales have marched upward in those 4 years, as have complaints from people who hate the noise in their neighborhoods. And so have injuries and deaths, including a Walled Lake man killed this week after he put a mortar shell to his head. He thought it was not lit, and tragically, it was. Let's sort out what's legal, what's not, and what bills have been introduced to roll back that fireworks law. Jonathan Osteen is back with us again, MLive's Lansing reporter. Jonathan, take us back to 2011 when lawmakers passed this fireworks law. What was the reason?
Well, the thinking was that a lot of people in Michigan were already buying these fireworks. Indiana and Ohio have been selling these kind of things for years. So the idea was the state wanted to get a piece of that revenue. You know, if people are buying them anyways, why not have them pay the taxes here on those goods and, you know, make some money off of these fireworks in the process.
And has that worked out?
Yeah, for the most part. Sales, as you mentioned earlier, have continued to grow. I think LARA, the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, says there was about $26.4 million in fireworks sales last summer. That was up from $17.5 million the year before. So we see a clear trajectory of those rising. The state makes most of its money off sales tax on those. There's also some fees that firework retailers pay, and those go to pay for an inspection program that the state runs, but local firefighters actually go in and inspect a lot of these facilities.
Speaking of a trajectory, there's also been an upward trajectory of complaints from people who are not happy with these going off at all hours in their neighborhood, especially around holidays like the 4th of July. And that prodded lawmakers to tweak the law in 2013, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. They basically gave local communities a little more flexibility to be able to prohibit overnight use of these consumer-grade fireworks around holidays, like the 4th of July, of course, is the big one. So the previous laws that was originally passed allowed communities to restrict use in other times of the years, but specifically tried to carve out these holidays as sort of a free-for-all. And I think, you know, we saw some negative consequences of that. So this doesn't require communities to ban use overnight. I mean, there's probably some less populated areas, you know, up in northern Michigan or the UP where it might not be as much of an issue. But it certainly gives locals that option.
And yet lawmakers are still hearing enough complaints. There's actually some who have introduced bills to tweak the fireworks law even more. So who's introduced what?
Henry Yanez, state rep out of Sterling Heights, a Democrat. He's a former firefighter, and he actually has introduced legislation along with 10 co-sponsors to actually repeal the law completely and go back to this sort of small-time fireworks we previously had. The bill hasn't got a committee hearing, and honestly, it's kind of an annual thing here in the legislature now. People introduce these measures, but I think there's probably a very small chance of going back now that we've opened the door to these fireworks.
And so, then what about other efforts? Maybe not quite deep dive as repealing the law.
That's the big one that I've heard of. I mean, certainly, as we talked already, the change in 2013 was prompted by complaints, and lawmakers certainly bring these up. But there hasn't really been any action on any bills anyways since that time.
So kind of give us a sense then, Jonathan, what are the do's and don'ts legally for setting off fireworks?
Well, you probably don't want to set off bottle rocket Roman candles next to your head, unfortunately.
Yes.
We heard that story. I'm not sure what the actual regulations are in terms of use. The state regulates more sales, so like facilities. So they require facilities to, display certificates, to have these safety inspections and things like that. Once consumers actually have the fireworks, there's time restrictions in place in certain communities, but that can be sort of a patchwork thing. So really, if you're living in an area, you probably want to figure out what your regulations are before, a police officer rolls by and cites you for letting off fireworks at a time you're not supposed to be.
I've got to wonder if, for those who are not happy with all the popping and the noise, if there are some no fireworks celebrations that are planned around the state.
good question. I don't know of any of those. I plan to participate in a personal no fireworks celebration, but I'm not sure if there's any critical mass in that direction.
I'll be with you there, Jonathan. Hey, thanks for the update on the fireworks scene in Michigan, and happy 4th of July to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks so much.
I'm Live Lansing reporter Jonathan Osting. Still to come, Poets at the Grand Hotel continues its proud history of bringing literary culture to Mackinac Island. That story in 15 minutes, a quest to find and photograph UP waterfalls as well. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called Poets at the Grand Hotel, and it's a chance for Mackinac Island visitors to take some time out from soaking up the sights, riding bicycles, and eating fudge to explore poetry. Every Wednesday morning in July and August, poet Jim Lenfesty presides over this weekly poetry gathering at the Audubon Room at the Grand Hotel. It's the 10th year for Poets at the Grand Hotel. It's also being marked by Lenfesty's latest book, Seeking the Cave. Welcome to the program, Jim.
It's wonderful to be here with you.
Why do you think this weekly gathering has worked for so long on Mackinac?
Well, the real credit to this first begins with Amelia Musser, who is of the family who owns and runs the Grand Hotel for three generations. And probably more than 30 years ago now, she recognized they needed some literary culture on the island. And so she made a deal with a guy named John McCabe, who was born and raised in Detroit with a stutter and became a leading professor of theater and ended up in a circuitous route living on Mackinac Island. And so for 25 years at the Grand Hotel, he taught a course in Shakespeare. It was really quite remarkable. And when my wife and I bought our cottage in 87, I began to go to those classes and thought it was quite terrific. And to my shock, after he retired at the age of 87, she asked me if I'd do something. So I was really part of a
tradition on the island of there being some sort of a literary event every week on the island. But when she asked me, I pondered it for several weeks, and I said, I'll tell you what, if you're interested, I'll do the same format, an hour a week, all summer, 8 weeks of 8 poets I love. And she said, fine. So for 10 years, I had no idea what that was going to be, the first year or the second, not to mention the 10th, but every year I keep finding poets I love. I thought I'd run out after a couple of years, but it continues. So it's been a joy for me and my kind of belief that this is a excellent way of looking at the outer world and the inner world within us, I think attracts people to come back every Wednesday and take part.
What happens in a typical session, Jim?
Well, first, I'll tell you this. What I do, and I've done this from the beginning, I start with ancient poets and I end with living poets. So, for example, this year I'm opening with Sappho, which is really quite timely given the current Supreme Court decision, which I didn't anticipate coming up, but, you know, she's the from the island of Lesbos. She's the world from which that word has become current.
Certainly.
But we're talking now, so we get to talk about a voice that's coming to us from the 6th century B.C.
So people come in, and they're welcome to just come sit down.
And the Grand has set this up in such a way that anybody can come. They waive all their fees, and people come in and just sit in this class. And nobody has any particular requirement to know or care about poetry. But rather, what they're going to learn is about who this person was, what they said, and how it touches them. And I firmly believe that poetry is about the reader, that it's designed to rearrange our insides and help us understand our way in the world.
And is that why you describe these gatherings as a form of secular preaching?
Exactly. No, well, I mean, I believe that. What I mean is that, you know, I get to use the greatest texts in the history of the world, but they come from the great literary tradition, not the great religious traditions. And they are addressed to the same problem. Who are we? What are we doing here? What's this all about? I used to be a journalist. I still am, in a way, but I've spent much of my career as a journalist. One of the things, a comparison between the two, is I like to say, you know, journalism is the relentless pursuit of the facts of the outer world and arranging them into a story that the reader can apprehend. And poetry is the relentless pursuit of the facts of the inner world and arranging them so that you, the poet, is illuminated by them, and one hopes that the reader is illuminated by them as well.
Jim, is it the role of a poet to be an activist, to get right in people's faces and say, hey, pay attention to this? I know you're very involved in trying to warn the world about climate change through your poetry?
Not really, no. But it's something that, you know, any alert human being today should be totally focused on solving the problem of climate change. This is not something poets should or shouldn't do, and other citizens shouldn't do. I mean, we all should be in high alarm. And that's because, you know, that's from my now 35 years of journalism covering this topic and knowing it all too well. But here's how I write poems. For me, suddenly there's a feeling or a word comes, and you wake up in the morning, and you're there, and suddenly your fingers head out ahead of you, or your pencil or your pen, and that story is revealed to you as the pen moves along. This isn't something that comes from the head. One of the things I say, when I was an editorial writer for a daily paper for a long time, and when I'd come home from that job, my head would be hot. When I write my poems, my hands are hot because it comes right out of the body. These poems come out of the body. They aren't, in fact, you want to get your head out of the way.
And just let it happen.
Yeah. Sometimes it's about climate. Sometimes it's about waking up in the morning. Sometimes it's about seeing the world differently. I'll give you a couple little examples. I mean, from last summer, we have a cottage on the East Bluff on Mackinac Island, and I get up at dawn every day, and that's the quiet time for me, and watch the golden light of the sunrise roar over the East Bluff there. There's always boats trolling for salmon in the straits every morning. Those fishers get up earlier than I do. And then there are the giant freighters that go through, the huge 1,000-footers that load up their taconite in Duluth and Taconite Harbor, and they come down and go down to the steel mills. Well, I've been looking at those boats for 25 years, actually longer, and suddenly
last summer, I saw them differently. I was watching the salmon fishers go by with their downriggers, and I saw that silver line go down below the surface of the water. And suddenly, for the first time in 25 or 30 years, I saw it as a metaphor. I saw it as a line going below the surface to find out what words were down there that tell the story of our emotional life. Just what I've been talking about.
Mm.
So it was a complete shock to me. So I followed that line down and tried to see where it went. If you're interested, I could read you this little poem. I mean, this completely surprised me. Now, I don't know if you know, all Great Lakes people should know, but not all do, that we have the alewife in the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the alewife is actually a herring that's from the Atlantic coast. But it's years ago, it swam up the St. Lawrence Seaway. Well, the etymology of alewife is possibly from a woman who kept an alehouse.
Hmm.
So that's a strange beginning.
Yes.
So trolling is the name of this poem.
All right.
At dawn, fishing boats drop their silver lines beneath the surface of the lake, down where big-eyed salmon swallow alewives and other slick elusives, some hiding a hook. What other good words swim in the deep? What syllables to hook the lip and tug the line? To feed us as their eyes go pale, mouths gaping at our feet, will they speak through me to you? In the buoyant universe below, fleshy barkeeps wipe rocky tables with seaweed skirts, offering their generous bodies to coho and chinook who belly up to swig. There, gleaming whitefish dance in swirls and wave their gills, and solitary sturgeon loiter at the dark end of the bar, refusing to rise to any bait. Their etymology shadowy, obscure, armor-plated, perhaps from a lost pre-Indo-European tongue. For we fishers at dawn are not ordinary men. We embrace the food of solitude, trolling back and forth, until a sound strikes our mouths with the taste of grace.
Well, if anybody's perfect to get us thinking about poetry and what it can do and doing it on Mackinac Island, it is Eugene Lenfesti. It's wonderful. And if you're on Mackinac any Wednesday morning, July and August, Jim will be waiting for you in the Audubon Room at the Grand Hotel. And he'll be making appearances to support his latest book, Seeking the Cave. And you can get all the details of his appearances on that website, coyotepoet.com. Jim Lenfesti, it was really fun to talk with you.
Well, what a joy to talk with you. Thank you for your wonderful radio program.
Thank you, and have a wonderful summer on Mackinac.
Okay, take care.
We've heard of storm chasers, tornado chasers. You could call Phil Stagg a waterfall chaser. Yes, he has a day job running his business in Cadillac, but his heart really lies in taking photographs of Michigan, especially the hundreds of waterfalls that grace the Upper Peninsula. And his waterfall love affair seems to have begun at Tequamanon Falls. Phil Stagg, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
So your passion to photograph Michigan's waterfalls really has grown into a project to give us a comprehensive full guide to all the waterfalls in the UP. When and how did that begin?
Well, it all started back in, I'm thinking about 08, when I accidentally took a really good picture of Tequamanon Falls, and it kind of ballooned from there.
You took that first photograph, and then another, and then another, and you really hadn't even taken photography classes then?
That's correct, right. I always had a kind of a passion for photography because for some reason or other, I don't have a visual memory. And because of that, you know, when I have a photo, I can at least remember an event because I can't pull it up, you know, in my mind.
So you have kind of embraced this idea to track down and photograph every waterfall or drop in the Upper Peninsula. How many have you got so far?
I've documented, I think it's around 580. I'd have to look at my database for sure because it keeps increasing. But there's an awful lot of waterfalling up there for sure.
And what's the idea? You want to put this into a book? You want to create a map?
Yes, I'm working on a guidebook series, actually. I'm at about 1,000 pages right now, so it doesn't fit very comfortably into one volume. So I've divided it up into four regions.
This has to be physically, you know, taxing, a lot of tromping and slogging into the woods.
Yeah, for sure. There are a lot that are close to the road, which is nice, and there are trails to quite a few, but certainly there are some that are, you know, they're kind of up there. They're off-grid, for sure.
Yeah, have you found ones that are not on maps?
Yeah, right. They're definitely not on any maps. That's one reason why I'm doing this project, is to make things accessible and knowable to the general public.
What's that perfect moment like when you've, you know, lugged your camera and gear through some woods and then you come on a waterfall, the lighting is perfect. What's that moment like?
Yeah, it's really a special thing. Specifically, I can think of when I did a long hike into Bulldog Falls, which is up in Marquette County. It was one of those October days where the air is crisp and it's getting close toward evening. And golden leaves were falling all around. And here's this really narrow footpath. Never been out there, didn't know what to expect. And it's a 2+ mile hike out to the beginning of the waterfalls. And I really didn't know what was out there. So the GPS coordinates I had were a little bit off. Instead of actually coming upon a waterfall, I came upon just some little rapids. And I was thinking, oh, no, how to be better than this? So I followed the river upstream. And all of a sudden, here's this wonderful cascade coming down into the Yellow Dog Plains up in Marquette County. And just beautiful, beautiful conditions. And, you know, it's really an awe-inspiring event at that point.
There are some stunning photos on your Facebook page, which is Phil Stagg Photography, and that's S-T-A-G-G, Phil Stagg Photography. I've enjoyed looking at them. And you've got some other things, too, like Vegas. And so you like to take that camera everywhere.
Well, I do, yes. And actually, that's just one of my Facebook pages. If you go to Waterfalls of Michigan, you'll find a lot more, and it's really specifically just waterfalls. And then I also have Michigan Waterfalls, which has waterfalls and other things. Those are all on Facebook.
And also mifalls.com if you want to buy your own prints, by the way. And do you have any kind of timetable? When do you think this book's going to be out, this guide?
Well, I was wanting it out already, so I'm a little bit past my own my desired publishing date. But I just continue to work on it, and I hate putting a time frame on it because then, you know, expectations and all make it difficult for me. But I want to get it out as soon as possible, for sure. Probably be a rolling send-off here. Originally, I wanted to get all four of them put out at the same time, but that's just an awful lot of work. So I'm probably going to start putting them out as I have them ready.
I'd love if you play a little game with us and just complete this sentence for us. The most magical thing about an Upper Peninsula waterfall is...
Oh, man, you're making this hard. the most magical thing is, I'd say, the beauty of Michigan.
Yeah, that sums it up. Photographer Phil Stagg, and you can find him on Facebook, and his website, again, is mifalls.com. Good luck with the quest to map all of those waterfalls, Phil. Great talking with you.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, everybody, this next story is about a late-night call from a dealer and a sketchy interaction near the Leelanau Peninsula. Our Detroit's wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook, is here to tell us all about an exhilarating experience he recently had that landed him with a stash of Morels.
One night last month, my wife and I ventured out from our rented Leelanau Peninsula cottage to a gathering spot where we had heard that the fried chicken reigned supreme. Soon, we were on a first-name basis with our chatty, personable waitress, who at one point mentioned that a male acquaintance had been in the woods that very morning and stumbled into a massive cache of fresh morels. He'd collected several pounds, she said, and now he wanted to sell them, because he was out of work and could use the money. Did we want some? Well, I said, I'll certainly buy a pound, and I gave her my cell phone number. We paid the bill and headed back to our new digs down the road. At about 10 p.m., my cell phone rings. Hello, this is John. You wanted to buy some stuff? Some stuff, I ask. Yes, mushrooms. Buy the mushrooms, John says. Oh, yes, the morels, I answered. Can you meet me, he asks. Well, yes. When? Now, where are you, he says. We agree to meet 15 minutes later. So in the dark of a moonless night, I head north to a prearranged drop spot in a parking lot. Driving to the meet, I get a sense of deja vu. This is mysteriously like going to buy some pot back in college. For a second, I get a flash of recall, worrying about cops. Is there a risk of getting busted for this? I pull into the meeting spot. and it's pitch dark. No hidden cop cars, just me and the crickets. Barely a minute goes by when at high speed, a mini SUV makes the corner. His lights pass over me. I let him see me. He sizes me up. He parks tail inward. I'm guessing he doesn't want me to see his license plate. John, a stocky man, and his girlfriend emerge from the truck. No greeting. We all know why we're here. Here it is, he says, holding out a brown paper bag crammed with Morels. Oh, I only wanted 1 pound, I say, in a kind of a junior league sheepish way. Oh, that wasn't the deal, John says, a little irritated. I know trouble when I hear it. Okay, I'll take it all and I'll figure it out later, I say, and I cough up another $20 and take the whole bag off his hands. He's back in the truck and gone before I can grab my door handle. I plunk my new stash, about 3 or 4 pounds of Morels, on my passenger seat and head back into the post-sunset shoreline glow, feeling oddly exhilarated. I kick back my seat, crank the radio. Yes, this is my kind of deal. Pretty exciting for a guy about to turn 70, well beyond the zigzag roller years. My kick these days? Well, breaking out the mushroom brush, cleaning and washing and prepping these babies for a great creamed morel sauce to go on a juicy steak. With a great bottle of wine, of course.
Still to come, sports commentator John U. Bacon on the Women's World Cup and the Red Wings' new acquisitions. That comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. History was written this week when President Obama made it official. The United States and Cuba will soon open embassies in Havana and Washington. This reestablishes diplomatic ties that were severed over 50 years ago.
When something isn't working, we can and will change.
And that change will be felt in Michigan. That's because the Cuban Chamber of Commerce has chosen the city of Troy in Oakland County for its third location and its headquarters in the United States. Dana McAllister is with us. She's the executive director of the Cuban Chamber of Commerce. Good to have you with us, Dana. Tell us, what do you want to accomplish in Michigan?
To be able to continue to build relationships with those who would like to do business in Cuba or perhaps be suppliers of those businesses that are already doing business in Cuba.
How long do you think it'll be before Michigan's economy will start feeling the benefits of doing business in Cuba, the kind of work you want to promote?
With our chamber, we're going to continue to promote our business organizations, our members, so that when the Iron Curtain falls, or parts, so to speak, they'll be ready to get started right away. There are some items that people can do business with currently, and the agricultural products are one. In addition to that, there's another license, and what that is medical equipment, medical supplies can be donated or sold. There's also the opportunities for consumer communications. You'll also find anything related to the environmental protection of the land, sea, and air, that there's special licenses for that. And finally, alternative energy. So there are opportunities currently now that sometimes individuals thought that you couldn't do.
How will you be operating?
We have some programs that are coming up. One is August 6th with Automation Alley, entitled Cuba, the New Frontier, Doing Business in Cuba. And we're also planning on some trade missions, either for consumers or for businesses as well.
Why Troy?
Troy, well, we are really appreciative with the support of the Oakland County government. And so they are helping support this particular effort because currently there are a few states that are running rapidly and they have infrastructures involved in order to accomplish this goal. I mean, imagine a country isolated for over 50 years. You have to do your research, you have to build bridges, etc. The state of New York, Governor Cuomo, has dedicated over $35 million between five countries, and Cuba is one of them. And there are other cities within Florida and Illinois as well. Well, the state of Michigan, we're waiting, and I feel confident that we will be able to have a strong infrastructure.
Daniel, let's take a moment now and listen to something that President Obama said yesterday when he announced the opening of the embassies in Washington and in Havana.
Yes, there are those who want to turn back the clock and double down on a policy of isolation. But it's long past time for us to realize that this approach doesn't work. It hasn't worked for 50 years. A year ago, it might have seemed impossible that the United States would once again be raising our flag, the Stars and Stripes, over an embassy in Havana. This is what change looks like.
This is what change looks like. Dana, what do you think from the perspective of the Cuban Chamber of Commerce? What could that look like for business in Michigan?
There's a lot of agricultural trade already. We see things such as the banking industry having a footprint in Havana, for example, and then also having a bank from Havana here in Michigan. So we see products from Michigan coming in the future once trade normalizes, which will be great. There's medications that we could hopefully utilize right away for diabetes patients. There's also cancer vaccines that we could, you know, patients within the United States can use. They're already having clinical trials currently in other countries, and they already have users of these particular pharmaceuticals. So I see the quality of life because of the trade benefiting both Cuba as well as the United States. Whereas businesses here, you know, naturally we're going to learn a little bit more about how the Cubans are doing their business or how they've been able to operate. Maybe we'll have more exchanges in the educational realm in addition to healthcare. Cuba has 100% literacy. The United States does not at this time. So it'll be very interesting to see how can we accomplish that or at least, you know, build our educational base throughout our state and throughout our country. Maybe we can learn from the Cubans.
So you see this as very much a two-way street.
It has to be. It has to be. Otherwise, you know, why do it?
Have you gotten pushback from those who do not agree at all with this new policy? What do you say to them?
Well, that's the beauty of the United States of America. We can all have our opinion. And let's see what's in the best interest of all United States citizens in the Cuban population. Albert Einstein did say the definition of insanity is to continue doing the same thing again and again, expecting a different result. 50 plus years, I think we've had enough time to research and see, you know, the results and the consequences of a current policy. And frankly, as President Obama stated, it's just not working. And the Cuban population has not benefited because of that. So, and that was the goal of why they had all these hardline policies.
We talked about a two-way street. Are you hoping that through the Cuban Chamber of Commerce, you can help impact the human rights situation in Cuba?
Regarding policies, we take a neutral approach, and we let our legislators handle all of that.
I'm talking with Dana McAllister, who's executive director of the Cuban Chamber of Commerce, setting up its headquarters and its third office in Oakland County in Troy. You said, Dana, you've noticed similarities between Detroit and Havana?
Between the architecture, the culture, the education. Both cities have had, you know, a lot of economy. And then for whatever, you know, whatever history wrote, there had been a severe decline in all of those realms. United States and Cuba and Detroit and Havana in particular have this opportunity to rise. And why not rise together?
The idea that the fact that this is one of three offices, the other two being in D.C. and then understandably in Miami, how do you envision this Troy office interacting with the other two offices?
In a fluid way, actually. We're so excited. In fact, we're planning awesome events in D.C. and Miami where members of the Michigan Chamber and vice versa can all participate. And so we're really excited to be able to connect the political piece because naturally politics are involved in everything, especially with the Cuba-U.S. policy. Having our pulse on, you know, on the current events and what's leading up to and how we can have change from an educational point of view. And of course, with Miami, I mean, Miami is our international port to Latin America. And then while we're waiting for trade to normalize, this is a great time for small business owners or medium-sized or entrepreneurs to get on board, and we'll help them if there's a product that they offer. And maybe right now it's not available in Cuba because of the embargo. Well, perhaps there's another small business in D.C. or we have members in Georgia, for example, that would like to purchase their product. Well, why not?
Give us an idea how many people in Michigan can claim Cuban ancestry. Do you have any idea?
They say around just a little bit over 9,800 from the last census. However, I would be interested to see how many people filled it out and how many people did not fill out the census.
Is there any particular area in Michigan where there's more of a concentration?
Sure. So the last wave of migration came during the 90s for the Balseros, which were the Cuban rafters. And so Miami obviously has a lot of immigrants already. Mm-hmm. So they had to relocate these immigrants from the Miami area. And Lansing already had its refugee center and they had space. What happened was they transferred them to Lansing. So you'll find more Cubans in the Lansing area.
How much traveling have you personally been able to do in Cuba?
I've traveled on multiple occasions.
What would you like us to know about the people in Cuba, the people on the other side of this big diplomatic and political equation?
I'm of Cuban ancestry, so I'm able to travel on the Cuban family visa. What I found, especially when I went there the first times, I was astounded at the resilience, the creativity, the entrepreneurship. You have cars from the 30s and they're still working. So when I see like the ingenuity of the Cubans, they're driving the car, for some reason it stops, and then they pull over and they fiddle with it and without parts from like a supply store, and they're able to get it running again. I was amazed by that. I was also amazed with the family structure. It was definitely beautiful to see, you know, families coming together and working together in order to get to the next level. Education. I was a former school teacher, so, you know, seeing how advanced the Cuban student is, being dedicated with their studies. But it was really eye-opening to see that, you know, they'd like to see their country move ahead.
Dana McAllister is the executive director of the Cuban Chamber of Commerce, setting up its headquarters and third office in Oakland County in Troy. You can get details at cubancc.org. Thanks so much for talking with us, Dana.
Thank you.
Time now to talk sports as we say hello again to Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. Let's start with those free agent deals the Red Wings signed this week with defenseman Mike Green and veteran center Brad Richards. Ken Holland says it's a great day for the Red Wings. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And the response you got from the stars like Zetterberg and Datsyuk, tell you this. Look, to win a Stanley Cup, you need the top line of hot shots. The Wings have got that. What people don't realize about this sport versus other sports is second and third line guys who play constantly. It's not like second string or third string. They don't get in. You have to have three lines of players, 15 players to play every night, usually four lines. And look back at the great Red Wings teams of the 90s, the 2000s. Maltby, Draper, these third line, fourth line grinders, as they're called, are essential because unlike basketball, look, in basketball, you, me, two other people, and LeBron James will beat most teams.
Exactly.
And I've not seen you play. In hockey, you can't do it that way. Gretzky, without the Oilers, never won a cup.
So with Mike Green, he's spent the past 10 years with Washington. He's getting a three-year deal worth $18 million. Good deal for Detroit?
And for him, of course.
But certainly.
These days, those are not salary cap busters. Yeah. So that's not too much to pay. So you're not handcuffing yourself to get somebody else.
And what is he bringing to the Wings specifically?
A right-handed shot on the power play, basically.
Which we need.
If you saw the power play. The power play, by the way, is when it's 5-on-4 for you non-hockey fans.
Yeah.
And that's when you got to score your goals.
Okay. And then we saw Brad Richards win his second Stanley Cup with the Blackhawks. He's getting 1 year worth $3 million. And I like this. He could earn another $1 million if the Wings get through two playoff rounds, which I think fans are really ready to see happen.
Red Wings fans are spoiled, flat out. And these days, if you don't get to the conference finals at least, it's probably a bad year around Detroit for most fans. This guy with two cups, that matters because you see exactly what it takes. And half the guys in the Red Wings have not gotten that far, frankly. So this is a great thing for Detroit.
And with Datsyuk's ankle surgery, it's kind of like having Richards as like a security blankie, isn't it?
Exactly right. He'll be getting plenty of ice time the first couple months.
With these signings, what does it tell you, say to you, about how other players around the NHL regard the Wings and their chance to win a Stanley Cup?
Very high. Look, I mean, let's be honest. Detroit's reputation as a city nationwide is a lot worse than it should be. We agree on that. And yet they can keep on getting first-flight, world-class talent because the Wings organization, from the Illiches on down, Ken Holland, the GM, might be the best in hockey and might be the best in sports.
I want to talk about Lord Stanley's Cup. Sean and I were lucky enough to have had a friend give us his tickets for June 13th, 2002, Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Series against North Carolina as we watched the Red Wings win their 10th Stanley Cup. And this week, two more members of that team made it to the Hockey Hall of Fame, Nick Lidstrom, Sergei Fedorov, and they belong in the Hall of Fame because?
because they are the two of the best players who ever played the game. That is not hyperbole. That is not an exaggeration. I was around for these guys, covering them a lot for the Detroit News, writing feature stories in the late 90s. Both, in my opinion, first-class acts. Nick Lidstrom is one of the great gentlemen of the game. He's won the Norris Trophy for the best defenseman in the league 7 times. Only one guy has won it more. His name is Bobby Orr. Even non-hockey fans know that name.
Yeah.
So he's as good as they come, obviously. Fedorov might be the most talented player I have ever covered. And he does not get the credit for that, of course. But he skated probably better than almost anybody. Beautiful skater, great puck handler. He went back to play defense for a few months for Scotty Bowman because the team needed that and did a great job on defense as well. That is a rare talent.
I remember how furious and spurned Detroit fans were when he absconded to Anaheim.
Absconded. I guess I know where you stand on this one.
Well, but it does seem things
dark of night.
Things are forgiven, aren't they?
Things are forgiven. And look, he did a great job for Detroit. They won 3 cups when he played in the team, and he was an essential piece of those championship teams.
Now, quickly over to Women's World Cup soccer. First, that match between the U.S. and Germany that sent the U.S. women into the World Cup final. We saw that head-to-head collision between Morgan Bryan and Germany's Alexandra Popp. Wow. Ow. And then they fall to AstroTurf. And then they're back in a few minutes later, blood and all.
Right.
And I got to thinking about how that contrasted with what the NFL is trying to do with concussions and head collisions. And should they have been back in?
We don't know.
Yeah.
And the problem is they don't know either. So what you need is a neurologist like Michigan has for football, Dr. Kutcher, Jeff Kutcher. On this one, what you need is somebody on the side. You can't really tell from how bad a collision is what the damage is. And I can tell you from playing hockey all these years, and you can just decide for yourself how many concussions I've had. But the big hits often are not the damaging ones, and sometimes the ones you don't notice are. One problem, for example, I've learned from Dr. Kutcher is that a wet soccer ball, when you head it, can do serious damage. So the point is this. We don't know, and they don't know, and that's the problem. There has to be for any collision sport, and soccer qualifies with both the headers as well as the head-to-head collisions. Mm-hmm. You need a doctor on the sidelines. Look, at that level, with that much money sloshing around these TV ratings and so on, they have no problem affording that.
And Germany's coach got a little testy when she was asked, should that player have gone back in, Alexandra Popp? And she said she was fine. Why wouldn't I send her back? But there's no neurologist on the sideline.
Have you been to Germany?
And then landing on AstroTurf.
You do as I say.
I know that there is a lot of heat aimed at FIFA for putting the women on AstroTurf for the World Cup because they don't do it to the men.
They don't. And the men would not play on it. And look, you're making money on this thing as well. FIFA is so deeply corrupt. It's magically corrupt. It's so amazingly corrupt.
We've seen lately.
Exactly. This is such an easy fix to make. It costs you essentially nothing. And it's such an obvious thing that everyone notices. And also the game is not the same on turf either. So that's bad, bad, and bad, but not even their worst sin.
Now it'll be the USA against Japan in the World Cup final after that heartbreaking own goal in the 92nd minute by England's Laura Bassett. It was just the saddest thing to see, and that sent Japan into the final. And that's the rematch from the 2011 final that USA versus Japan that Japan won. What do you think we might see Sunday?
I think the U.S. will be motivated like never before, I swear, that they lost to Japan and still a bitter loss. The U.S. has been the dominant team in women's soccer for basically since it started 20 years ago. They have not won the World Cup since Brandi Chastain, of course, pulled off her jersey famously.
Very.
That's 16 years ago. They hear about it all the time. They are sick of hearing about it. These women on the team now were maybe 8 when that happened, and they will be one of the most determined teams you'll ever see. I'd be shocked if they don't win this one.
You think we're seeing soccer fans, a.k.a. football fans,
yes,
growing
as your husband would say.
The rest of the world calls it football. Are they growing deeper roots here in the U.S.? Are they drawing in new fans, or is this still a sport that just speaks to the soccer faithful?
It is definitely spreading. Women's Cup has not spread the way the Men's Cup has yet. But I will say the Men's Cup, when you walk around Ann Arbor, all the pubs are filled at 2 o'clock in the afternoon watching Italy versus Germany or Brazil versus Argentina or whatever you've got. It is definitely getting a foothold. It's slow to happen, I must say. We've been playing soccer in the U.S. in high schools for about 40 years now, and it's still not really grabbed the audience the way football has, baseball, and so on. But it is happening generation by generation. It's definitely going the right direction.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Ubagan. Thanks, John.
Cindy, always a pleasure.
To Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. And today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Ava Obrecht, Jake Offenharth, Shana Roth, and Katrina Schaefer. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Have a very, very happy 4th of July holiday weekend. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.